The Koch brothers intend to spend $889 million in the 2016 presidential race, more than doubling the amount spent by the Republican National Committee in 2012. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Day today, and joining for the discussion are political analysts Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa and Stephen Schmidt of Iowa State University. We'll talk campaign spending and analyze Steve King's Republican Freedom Summit that happened over the weekend in Des Moines.
Do you believe that the next president of the United States is going to be speaking from this stage to you today?
Join us for Politics Day after this news from NPR. Good afternoon. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Day today, and with me for the hour, Stephen Schmidt, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Emily.
And Tim Hagel, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa, here with me in the Iowa City studio. Hi, Tim.
Hey there.
And we're going to be talking about the Iowa Freedom Summit held in Des Moines over the weekend a little bit later into the hour. But first, on Monday, the Koch brothers network announced plans to spend $889 million in the run-up to the 2016 presidential election. How much money is an election worth to you? What's your reaction to the Koch brothers' announcement? You can join our conversation this hour. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, post to our Facebook page, or email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. And again, that number to call is 866-780-9100. Now, the money from the Koch Brothers Network will come from 17 organizations funded by Charles and David Koch, among other wealthy donors. $889 million would go a long way to making this the most expensive election in U.S. history. For comparison, the National Republican Party spent about $675 million in the 2012 election. Even while GOP 2016 hopefuls were gathering in Iowa this weekend, the Koch brothers were hosting their own event. Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, Florida Senator Marco Rubio, and Texas Senator Ted Cruz were all in attendance. ABC News Jonathan Carl moderated the event and asked the trio if there's too much influence by the super wealthy in politics. Here's what Senator Rubio said.
I think that political spending and political activism is a form of protected speech. There is a gentleman out there who has radical environmental ideas, who has spent tens of millions of dollars, lost most of his races, but spent tens of millions of dollars attacking Republicans that didn't want to impose his radical environmental agenda. He has a right to do that. I believe in freedom of speech, and I believe that spending money on political campaigns is a form of political speech that is protected under the Constitution. And the people who seem to have a problem with it are the ones that only want unions to be able to do it, their friends in Hollywood to be able to do it, and their friends in the press to be able to do it.
So, Tim, Stephen, what's your take on this? What's your reaction to this news?
Well, aside from sort of the obvious take on it, one of the first things I thought of as well, if they're going to be spending $889 million, that's probably going to provide a lot of jobs up and down the line, a lot of spending for media, so it'll help TV stations and things of that nature. And of course, ultimately, I'm always thinking jobs for my students, that they'll be able to help out with these various groups and so forth. But, you know, Rubio kind of hit it. He didn't mention Tom Steyer's name, but that's who he was talking about. And you've got George Soros on the left. So it's both the left and the right. And I know that people often complain about the amount of spending, but it becomes more expensive. And to the extent that, you know, both sides are basically spending more and more, it's to some extent to be expected.
Do you think there's a cap to it, though? I mean, or not cap, but you know, limit to doing this, or just exponentially every election will be more than the previous one?
Stefan, you want to hit that one? Give you a turn.
Well, I mean, the Supreme Court has pretty much prohibited limiting spending because, as you and I and all of us know, corporations are people too, and so. With each Supreme Court ruling under this court, the permissiveness of allowing large amounts of money to be collected and aggregated and distributed has improved. And so there's no limit to it. And Politics was always expensive. Rich people always gave money. It wasn't quite this much, but it is, you know, a kind of phenomenon that we will be discussing for a long time. Now, you can't really buy elections. I mean, there, a lot of people have tried. Individuals have run campaigns. Billionaires in California have run campaigns to try to get elected and have bombed. And so money isn't everything. Candidates have to be good. They have to campaign. They have to be able to connect with people. And I think that it's yet to be proven that you can actually buy elections. As long as Democrats and Republicans both have a good pool of billionaires and large corporations to give, it'll be kind of like the mutually assured destruction between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, where both sides have massive amounts of money and throw them at each other.
Now, Tim, you mentioned jobs. You know, I wonder what other things you anticipate this money being spent on. With the Braley-Ernst race, there was a lot more, in just kind of anecdotally, in my opinion, there was a lot more spending on internet ads. Do you have any predictions on, you know, what specifically some of this money will go towards?
Well, apparently it's going to be spent on a variety of races, not just necessarily the presidential race, and it's going to be spread out in various ways. And so what you have is certain groups that, and again, this isn't just for the Koch brothers, but for, you know, all the folks that are going to be spending money on both sides. But you've got, say, Americans for Prosperity, and for that's a Koch brothers funded organization. And so they hire a number of people, and including, as I was mentioning before, only somewhat facetiously, is that they hire a number of students to do various work. So they'll go out, and they started, actually, Americans for Prosperity started fairly early in the 2014 election cycle, going out and doing some initial talking to people, obviously gathering names and information, but also doing sort of some early polling, finding out what issues were on people's minds, and that helped them later on. And so to the extent that they were hiring students at, you know, whatever it was, $10 or more an hour to go out and do that kind of stuff, it does provide some jobs. Now, that's sort of the low end of things, but then you also have consultants, and then you mentioned the internet, and that's probably fairly inexpensive, but then of course they have production costs that go into that as well, plus the ads that then do make it into the more traditional media, particularly television and radio. And so all of that kind of filters down. So in some sense, it's sort of recycling that money in certain ways that really do translate to jobs, and particularly in a state like Iowa, which tends to get a little bit more, I would suspect, than the average amount of media attention.
If you have an opinion on this, if you have questions for our political analysts, go ahead and give us a call. Join our discussion at 866-780-9100. On the line right now from Ames is Marianne. Hi, Marianne. Good afternoon.
Well, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Sure. I have to say, when I heard the amount of money the Koch brothers have already committed, it literally makes me sick to my stomach. The amount of money being spent on elections is nothing short of disgusting, and it goes on both sides. It doesn't matter what political party you're from. I think Citizens United has opened a horrible can of worms in letting this amount of money to control. And one of your people there said that it's not really buying elections. It is. It is, because it's not the voice of the everyday person. It's the voice of the wealthy. I just recently saw the movie Pay to Play, and the role that money's playing in this, the role that ALEC is playing in this, which is all controlled, that's an offshoot of the Koch brothers, and it's controlling legislation, and we're losing our democracy. We have something very special here in a democracy, and this is not a democracy anymore. It makes me really, really angry as a citizen.
Marianne, thank you so much for your call. So, Stefan, Tim, you know, is there some concern against backlash against all this money and spending?
Well, there are a lot of people like our caller who think there's too much money in politics. A lot of media think there's too much money in politics, but it's like everything else. I mean, you know, it's become an expensive industry. You're going to raise the money somewhere. Politics has always been driven by money. If you go back, you think elections in the past were pristine and there wasn't a lot of money being slipped out to people. You know, candidates used to give liquor out to the voters and get them to the polling places by passing out whiskey bottles. So I think it's naive to think that elections were always pristine events where individuals made up their own mind and then went and voted with their own conscience. There have always been these outside influences.
Tim, what do you think of Mary's statement that money can buy elections? Do you think that's true to an extent?
You know, it is to a certain extent, but, you know, we do see examples where it's not. One of the main ones had to do with former majority leader in the House, Eric Cantor, who outspent his opponent, what was his first name, David, I think, Bratt, by something like 10-1, and yet was basically lost. And then Bratt went on to win that particular congressional election. So he's one of the new members of the House of Representatives from Virginia. So you can certainly pick examples, and Stefan was saying before, and Rubio was saying that Tom Steyer had spent a lot of money and basically did not fare very well. There have been a number of fairly wealthy people that have run for California Senate or other offices that have lost. So it's not everything, but on the other hand, it does provide a certain amount of access, and especially in a situation like we're probably seeing now, with whether it's on the right, the Koch brothers having their forum, or, you know, other people doing it on the left, where you have to, as a candidate, line up big donors. And so that means that they have a certain amount of access to these folks. And that's understandable. But you have to hopefully reach some sort of a balance between the need to raise that kind of money, but then also listening to folks. And so in a situation like we are here for the Iowa caucuses in particular, and we'll talk more about that later in the hour, but it's not that every person that goes to the caucuses for the Democrats or the Republicans is bought by some big money donor. Now, maybe being able to reach out to those people requires money, and to get them to go to the caucuses requires money or vote in a primary. But it's not that all these folks are bought.
Since you bring up the Iowa caucuses, I wonder how much of this money do you both anticipate being spent before the Iowa caucus? Or do you see a lot of it happening after a candidate's been chosen by Iowa?
Well, I would say that it's probably going to be a fair amount is going to be spent here, as it usually is, also in New Hampshire and elsewhere, because, of course, it doesn't just all go here and then all of a sudden switch over to New Hampshire come the day after the caucuses, that you've got to be running campaigns at the same time. But because Iowa caucuses gets a lot of attention, that a lot of money will be spent here. And so it requires things like buses and staffers and people to help you organize things. And so a lot of money goes into that as well. Plus, of course, then the advertising ultimately that ramps up just before the caucuses.
Brian has a question from Dallas County. Brian, hi, are you there? Hello, Brian. Oh, we seem to have lost Brian, but Brian had the question, what do the Koch brothers want for their money? How much do we know about what campaign donors, you know, want in exchange for their support? Stefan?
Well, one of the things they want is lower taxes and less regulation, because they're into all kinds of businesses, and Congress obviously can basically moderate or increase the amount of regulation that there is and the taxes. But interestingly enough, I mean, one of the things the Koch brothers are very passionate about is to fundamentally change the judicial system. They think that too many people are being convicted and thrown in jail for nonviolent offenses, burdening the system. And in particular, I just saw a piece that one of the Koch brothers wrote with somebody else. They said it pits certain individuals against law enforcement and creates these horrible tensions in communities where law enforcement is arresting young Black men and Hispanics, as an example, for minor possession of drugs, and it sours the whole relationship between law enforcement and the community. And that's, in a way, a very sort of progressive position to take. So I think the Koch brothers have a whole bunch of different things where they want to be able to be heard and influence the shaping of public policy. They are not only conservative, wealthy billionaires. They also have some social agendas that to many people actually would be very appealing.
Well, and right now we're kind of at this point where the Republican Party can, you know, people can divide them into factions a little bit. But how much do we know about what type of conservative the Koch brothers are? Do they fit in a certain faction of the Republican Party, or are they kind
of... as Stefan was saying, that they're, you can't pigeonhole them completely. And in fact, what they would describe themselves as, and I've seen them described elsewhere, is more libertarian, actually. Yeah. And so if you are taking a more libertarian position, not perhaps unlike what you saw with Ron Paul, and maybe we'll see with Rand Paul when he fleshes out his positions, is that they do tend to be more fiscally conservative and also want less regulation. That's understandable in sort of the business context, but as Stefan was indicating, they also want a little less regulation in that criminal justice context. And so that's kind of what the libertarian position is too, saying, look, too many nonviolent offenders are being put in jail. This causes this plethora of problems. And so they're interested in that as well. And so whether it's the Koch brothers or any large donor, they probably have some things that they want to accomplish. And sometimes you can accomplish that through foundations, through education, donations, and things like that. But sometimes, obviously, you have to go for the political side of things. And that means spending money on potentially candidates that would support the kinds of things that you support.
Tanya is calling us from Des Moines. Tanya called 866-780-9100. Hi, Tanya. What's your question this hour?
I don't have a question. I have an idea, because I don't think it's possible to stop people from donating. It's a free country. But I don't understand why we couldn't tax all political contributions, say, at a flat 10% rate, tax it, take all that money, and put it towards not our budget, but our national debt. So someday we could possibly get our grandchildren out of the horrendous debt this country carries.
Hmm. What do you guys think about that? Interesting idea from Tanya.
This must be a liberal who's calling. She wants to tax and spend. Well, not spend, but tax anyway. Well, you know, I mean, the Koch brothers probably are paying pretty substantial taxes on all of their various enterprises. And I think the political parties certainly would never pass legislation that would tax campaign contributions. And it may be that the Supreme Court would then say, well, you're taxing free speech, and so that's unconstitutional. I don't know. It's an interesting idea.
What's your reaction, Tim?
Yeah, it'd basically be what we call a surtax, which is it's a tax on money that's already been taxed, and that's part of it. So that you're taking, you know, money that you paid an income tax on or a corporate tax or whatever it happens to be, and then you're taxing that again. And Stefan's right in that if you're taxing a particular use that the Supreme Court has already said is basically you exercising your First Amendment right to free speech, that would likely be problematic.
Up next is Dustin in Okoboji. Hi, Dustin.
Hi, how's it going?
Hey, good.
Yeah, I guess I just wanted to make a general point of the culture of democracy and what we're seeing as far as political elections go, especially in matters of donations. And I guess this, I just kind of want to touch on the idea that, like, the Koch brothers are somehow progressive, and I just think that's kind of laughable. Just a few years ago, they're trying to support legislation that would actually begin segregation again in certain areas.
What are you referencing in particular?
There is a case in Illinois where they were pushing for separating a school district, which I don't think many people are aware of, but the wonderful thing about living in the age of technology is that we have access to this kind of information. And it's just also just like general corruption itself. To think that, like, these massive donations don't have some type of influence on decisions is quite frankly naive. And also just kind of goes into the idea of just a couple years ago, Princeton came out with a report, actually I think it was last year, saying that we are in fact an oligarchy, not a democracy. And I'm sorry. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think there's this lack of understanding of how the money is being moved, and we give this excuse of traditionalism, saying this is how it's always been, so it doesn't really need to change. But in the 1930s, we called this a political machine. And what we're seeing with my generation, I'm 22, what we're seeing with my generation is this rise in understanding that this is not how things should be, and we're not actually treating the country or treating our citizens as we should be.
Well, Dustin, so thanks for this call.
Yeah, it's creating this situation where it's kind of like a 1964 situation where there's this cultural rise. My generation, we were made promises, and now we have to dig ourselves out of a hole.
Well, Dustin, thank you so much for your call. And I wonder, you know, that cynicism of, you know, today's youth, kind of that politics is too influenced by money, too much corruption going on. Is too much money in elections contributing to cynicism felt today?
Well, it probably is. And certainly when you hear folks like Dustin talk along those lines, that certainly gives you some evidence of that. And to the extent that you have a lot of people that regularly complain about the amount of money that's in politics for one reason or another, although usually when people are complaining, they're complaining from one side or the other, that they say, oh, if they're on the left, they're complaining about the Koch brothers. If they're on the right, they're complaining about Steyer or Soros or somebody else. And so when that kind of gives people the impression that you don't have, as an ordinary citizen, you don't have any say and so forth. But it's still, people have to go to vote, aside from any any things that perhaps that are untoward happening at the ballot box. But for the most part, it's still getting voters out to vote. And one of the reasons that you have a lot of money in politics these days is that there's this ever increasing desire to try to get those few people that don't vote out to the polls, get them registered and get them turned out. And this is particularly true for younger voters, because everybody knows that on a regular basis that their turnout rates are much lower than for people that are a little bit older.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're coming up towards the end of the first half, but I'd like to touch on briefly McConnell and the Senate. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is having a hard time running a caucus, with senators starting to depart from conservative positions on issues like climate change and energy. We have the Keystone Jobs Bill, even though the bill known as the Keystone XL pipeline failed in the Senate. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says he's encouraged that the Senate is back to work.
We've actually reached a milestone here that I think is noteworthy for the Senate. Now, we just cast our 15th roll call vote on an amendment on this bill, which is more roll call votes on amendments than the entire United States Senate in all of 2014.
So how will McConnell navigate this new Senate? Do you think he's going to have just as tough a time as John Boehner's had?
Stefan, you want to start on that one?
Well, every leader has problems with all kinds of independent-minded politicians. Remember, senators especially, there are only 100 of them, and they've always been very independent. And they depend on the voters back in their states. They have their own visions of what is good for their state or for the nation. And if you're, the majority leader in the Senate, you've got to be able to essentially bargain with these people, get them on board, give them things. Politics is ugly. They say you don't want to watch sausage being made, and they also say you don't want to see Congress making laws, because there's a lot of stuff going on that isn't just straight ethical stuff. You're giving somebody a huge federal chunk of money if they will support your legislation.
Yeah, we have about a minute left. I want to give Tim a little time to respond as well.
I just kind of pick up on what Stefan was saying, is that it can be a difficult process. And of course, now what you've got is a number of senators who are going to be up for re-election in 2016. And so, of course, they're starting to look towards making sure that they're not going to be tagged by their eventual opponents, either within their party and if they get primaried, or for the other party, as being too much hewing to the line of Republicans. They want to show themselves as independent thinkers and so forth. And so you're going to see some defections from the Republican majority, just as you did from Democrats. And so this is basically how it goes. And of course, Republicans did very well in 2010, so that means a lot of them are up for re-election in 2016.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to River. We'll be back in just a few minutes. It's Politics Day today, and with me is Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa and Stefan Schmidt at Iowa State University, our political analysts this hour. In the second half, we're going to be talking about the Iowa Freedom Summit that happened over the weekend. Alaska Governor Sarah Palin, Texas Senator Ted Cruz were there, among a couple dozen prominent Republicans. Of the possible GOP frontrunners for 2016, is there anyone you could support for a presidential run? Give us a call, 866-780-9100. We'll be back in just a few minutes. This is River to River. Glad you're joining us this hour on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Day today, and with me for the hour, Stefan Schmidt, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Hi, Stefan.
Hey there.
Hey, welcome back. And Tim Hagel, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa.
Hey.
Hey. Well, As you both know, this past weekend, a couple dozen prominent Republicans attended the Iowa Freedom Summit in Des Moines, an event put on by Citizens United and Congressman Steve King. You know, many consider the Freedom Summit the start to the Iowa caucus season, even with the Iowa caucus a year away. Of the possible GOP frontrunners for 2016, is there anyone you would support for a presidential run? Asking you, listeners, who do you think is most viable for the presidency? Call us and tell us why at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, post to our Facebook page, or email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. So, you know, Tim, we were just talking, you sat down Saturday for the whole, you know, what, eight, nine hours. Right. You know, who was there? What were they talking about?
Well, it was a pretty big lineup. Obviously, it's I kind of hate this particular characterization, but a cattle call for candidates, potential candidates. Not everybody that was there, I think, is necessarily running for president. Some raising their profile, so I'm still thinking about running for president. But you had mostly from the conservative side of things. Ted Cruz was there. Mike Huckabee, Rick Santorum, Carly Fiorina was there. Then some newer faces. Scott Walker was there, made his sort of first major appearance here in Iowa. Dr. Ben Carson was there, and Donald Trump was there as well. But of course, there were some notable possible candidates that weren't there, including Governor Bobby Jindal. Jeb Bush and Mitt Romney weren't there. Chris Christie was there, so he represented perhaps a more moderate wing of the party, or at least in the eyes of some. And their purpose of being there was different. There were different types of speeches, that some were more the kind of the red meat, fire up the base kinds of speeches. Some were more policy oriented. Some were more biographical, introducing themselves to a wider audience of Iowans, even if they'd been here before. So it was an interesting set of speeches.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Jeb Bush. We have Senator Rand Paul wasn't there as well, Governor Jindal. What does that say about the Freedom Summit that they didn't make it? What does that say about, you know, the Iowa caucuses?
Stephen, you want to weigh in?
Well, I mean, Steve King is a very conservative Tea Party Republican, and, you know, he invited everybody, but it was pretty clear that this was a meeting which would be attended by very conservative Republicans. And I think the people who didn't show up just simply didn't want to have their political identity defined by that event, which was covered by, as if you were there, it was covered by a huge number of reporters. I mean, it's almost as big as the Iowa caucus night. And I had reporters from France and from Venezuela and other places asking me about it. Because it truly was the kickoff of the 2016 presidential election season. And so anybody who showed up there would then basically either be booed, because you remember when somebody brought up Governor Jeb Bush's name, and the crowd actually booed and was very hostile.
We actually have a clip that was reality TV star and businessman Donald Trump. He was in attendance at the Freedom Summit, and he called out Jeb Bush and Mitt Romney, who weren't in attendance.
So you can't have Jeb Bush, and he's going to lose. Aside from that, he's not going to win. So Mitt and you just can't have those two. That's not.
What do you think hearing that, Tim?
Well, you know, it's funny, and I can't entirely agree with Stefan on this. I think that if Jeb Bush had shown up there, he probably, you know, Trump may have still gotten some applause for the "you can't have Bush" line, because certainly that's something that, as much as Democrats would not like to see another President Bush, there are many Republicans that would not like to see another President Bush. And partly it has to do with dissatisfaction towards the end of George W. Bush's term, that he turned out to be too much of a big government Republican for a lot of more movement conservatives. And also there's some particular concerns about Jeb Bush regarding particularly immigration and common core issues, but I think that he can probably explain some of those away, as Chris Christie did, because he came on and he talked about, yeah, I initially supported this, but, you know, it changed and I changed my mind on this. So if you explain those things, come to Iowa and explain those things, you're usually better off. I don't, you know, it's not you're going to make everybody happy, but you can at least say, look, I'm trying to connect with a particular audience. And so that's why Christie, at least maybe he wasn't as well received as some would suggest, although his speech speech wasn't, as I said, the kind of red meat connect with the base kind of speech. It was more this is what I believe, this is where I'm at, and that's the kind of thing that he's known for.
Mm-hmm. And do you agree with Stefan that the Iowa Freedom Summit is almost as big as the Iowa caucuses?
Oh, no, probably not that. Well, certainly it's big for this kind of an early kickoff event, and so we may very well see this again. And I know that even some of my students talking to them last night were saying, oh, it's still too early. I think they're still recovering from the effort that they put in for the 2014 election cycle, but it really is about time. It's kind of time to see them get going, the candidates get going, get them into the race. But, you know, we'll still have people thinking about it over the next couple of months. And I was looking back at the last election cycle, and we had people that were, you know, still thinking about it well into March and even into the summer. And of course, you know, famously, Rick Perry didn't get in until August. So we've got some time to go before everybody has to be in or out, but it's not a bad idea to kind of get a start, particularly if you're not as well known a candidate. Mm.
Who is the Iowa Freedom Summit aimed at? I mean, is this aimed at caucus goers, or is this a way to, you know, rally supporters who are going to be working on campaigns? Stefan?
Well, both. I mean, you know, it's aimed at Republicans. I can tell you, you know, Democrats had their own little event. I will call it ineffective little event across the street. The Democrats.
And what was that?
Well, I mean, the chair of the Democratic National Committee, who is, in my view, a very ineffective chair for the Democrats. They need to get rid of her very quickly and hire somebody who can connect with the groups of people that the Democrats have lost. And the new chair of the Iowa Democratic Party had a little press conference, but, you know, they were certainly not the audience. It was conservative Republicans, and I would say mostly Tea Party conservative Republicans. You got to understand and accept the fact that the Iowa Republican Party has at least three wings: the conservative Tea Party wing, the Rand Paul, you know, libertarian wing, and then you've got Country Club Republicans, the establishment Republicans, who I don't think felt very comfortable going to this event because they're more nuanced. They don't take the harsh position on various issues that the more conservative Republicans would like to see represented. And there is a fundamental disagreement in the Republican Party as to what kind of a presidential candidate they need. The people who were at this event think the party has missed the boat by not having a really hardcore conservative as their presidential contender, and they claim that that person would win the election. The Country Club Republicans are saying, no, you've got to have someone who can reach out to independents and maybe even to some Democrats and build a national coalition in November. And so there is this real huge disagreement in the Republican Party on what type of a person to nominate this time around.
Mm-hmm. Calling from Iowa City, we have Jeff. Hi, Jeff. Good afternoon.
Howdy.
What do you think? What's your take on this?
Well, I'm really heartened when I heard Mitt Romney come out the other day, you know, last week, whatever, saying his number one mission is to eradicate poverty, and secondary, trying to further that to eliminate the wage gap. And I want to tie that into in California's last election, as I understood, they had the provision on the ballot to raise the minimum wage. It was entirely financed by a libertarian millionaire. You know, the argument being it's good for business as well as the right thing to do. And I just think the Republicans are stealing a march on the Democrats. The Democrats, you look at them in Iowa, they're backing up on what they want for the minimum wage. Other places are going for raising it to $15. We went 10 last year, and this year going $8. That's not going to go anywhere. Next year, I suppose they'll ask for a nickel. Mm-hmm.
Jeff, thank you so much for your input from Iowa City. And if you want to join our conversation, you can also give us a call at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk, post to our Facebook page, or email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. You know, since Steve King hosted this event, I wonder what you both think about Steve King being called the kingmaker. You know, is he a kingmaker? Is he likely to be? What do you think?
I think part of that is just because of his last name.
Yeah.
That it makes for an easy kind of call. But I saw many people using that. And again, as I mentioned earlier, they called it a cattle call. And they talked about how they have to kiss King's Ring, the Kiss the King's Ring. And I wasn't real thrilled with some of those characterizations that we're going to have these sorts of things. This is for the Republicans. We'll have to see if anything similar happens for the Democrats. It has in the past in various ways when there's been a more open race. This time it seems that everybody's more or less waiting for Hillary on the side of the Democrats, although not entirely. You do have some people making some moves, whether it's Bernie Sanders or former governor of Maryland, O'Malley. But at least for the Republicans, we have to have these kinds of events and somebody has to put them on. And it's no surprise that if Steve King wants to play an important role, and he's going to reach out to a more conservative audience, as Stefan was saying. So mm-hmm. it's no surprise there. And the types of people that attended the event, the audience members, did tend to come from the more conservative part of the Iowa Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. And Stefan, do you think King achieved his goals by hosting this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was a gigantic success. He captured the entire national agenda of politics for that weekend and even for the week afterwards. You know, C-SPAN covered it live. You know, people who would never pay any attention to Iowa politics were almost forced to pay attention this early. And this is extremely early. I mean, I don't know if we remember that or not. This is very early for something that big to roll out. And there are other things that are coming out as well. There's this summit meeting for presidential candidates on agriculture. There are a couple of more meetings of conservative Christian Iowa groups that are going to have presidential forums. I mean, Iowa is jumping the gun on every other part of the country with an enormous rollout of events that are going to be covered. So Steve King essentially put himself in first place, got the thing rolling. I think the establishment Republicans, to be honest with you, are somewhat upset by it because they think that it was a conservative event that may have chilled some of the other less conservative candidates who, you know, we want them to come to Iowa. So there's a little bit of a struggle going on within the party on this.
Mm-hmm. If you just tuned in, this is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I am here, Emily Woodbury, with Stefan Schmidt and Tim Hagel, our political analysts this hour. There's been some conversation nationally about whether Iowa's still representative of voters as a whole. What do you both think about the fact that this summit happened specifically in Iowa? And Stefan, you mentioned other events happening in Iowa. Do you think that is only good? Only positive for the state of Iowa remaining first in the nation?
Well, I like it. And there is no state that is representative of the United States. You know, I mean, which state would you pick? You wouldn't pick Vermont and you wouldn't pick, you know, New Mexico. And Iowa doesn't really pick the presidential candidate. It's just a forum where people can come and candidates can come and kind of try out their message. And then they have to go and win in New Hampshire, or if they don't win there, then go on to win lots of other primaries and caucuses to get the number of delegates. So I think we're a good place to start. We're colorful. We have little piglets and big bales of straw and hay that can be used as props and backdrops. And the state fair, all of which adds a lot of great color for the media, for their visuals.
What do you think, Tim?
One of the things that I saw that came out of this, and Stefan was talking earlier about all of the national media that were here, is that we started to see some of the anti-Iowa comments that, why do you have to come to Iowa in the winter? And Iowa's weird and things of that nature. And I saw one particular comment from former member of Congress from New Hampshire that decided to take a shot at Iowa. He said, you know, that the standard, and this is a New Hampshire saying apparently, that Iowa picks corn and New Hampshire picks presidents. And I pointed out to him that, in fact, the last two presidents had won the Iowa caucuses and not won the New Hampshire primaries. And, in fact, even the third, going back three presidents, had not won their New Hampshire primaries. So he didn't respond to me. This was on Twitter. He decided not to respond. But, you know, the thing is true is that Stefan's right that people complain. They say, well, Iowa's not representative. But, you know, what other state are you going to pick? And the fact is that you have in Iowa a good balance. It's a purple state. It's a swing state. So it's important not just for the caucuses. And the fact that we go first and we're starting this process. And quite frankly, it's a lot of work for Iowans, too, that show up at events like a Freedom Summit where you're sitting there for the people that showed up for 8-9 hours or for the Democrats in various forums and so forth. So it's not something that we take lightly here.
Mm-hmm. Now, we talked about some of the bigger names, and we'll continue talking about them that were at the Freedom Summit. But Dan is calling from Des Moines. Dan, you were impressed with someone we haven't talked about yet.
Yeah, I just wanted to see, get some of your opinions on Carly Fiorina. I think she did an excellent job. She's intellectually and philosophically, I think, got the right kind of thing going on. She did a very in-depth kind of speech, and it wasn't necessarily a rabble-rouser, and yet it did a good job. She did a good job. I know she lost the boxer in California, but I'm not sure the Blessed Virgin Mary as a Republican could win in California these days.
And Dan, were you following her before the Freedom Summit? Or?
Well, I knew who she was. Mm-hmm. She really hasn't been that high profile for a national office till I think now she's after it. But anyway, I just wanted to get an opinion about it. I think she's got lots of good things to offer, maybe as a VP candidate, if nothing else.
All right. Thanks for your call, Dan. So, you know, Dan obviously impressed with her. Who are some of the other people that were there that you think really came out on top?
Actually, let me start with Carly Fiorina. That there were actually two speeches that at least some of the Republican pundits that were analyzing this that thought did really well. First was Scott Walker, who came out basically kind of a biographical thing, as I was saying before, that was his first major introduction. Mm-hmm. He's been here a little bit in Iowa. It hasn't been as much as some other folks because he had to win his own re-election in 2014. But he impressed a lot of people, and so it seems like he was off to a good start. But the second person a lot of people mentioned was, in fact, Carly Fiorina, who gave a little bit more low-key type of speech. She did have one zinger on Hillary Clinton that had stuck with a lot of people. But what I saw a lot of folks talking about afterwards, that she may be excellent vice presidential material, particularly if, in fact, Hillary Clinton is the nominee. The Republicans would do well to look for a woman to be the vice presidential candidate, or perhaps a Hispanic. So Rubio is potentially somebody who might be considered for that slot as well.
Seven, do you have some thoughts?
No, I agree. I mean, I think she's just enough of an outsider. I don't like her presentation style all that much. She seems sometimes to be condescending, and she sort of smacks her lips and stuff. I think she's got to get Joni Ernst's campaign handlers to fix that. But other than that, you know, she's never won office and run for office, and that's a very dangerous thing because politics is not business, and she's business. And she failed in business as well as failing to get elected in California. And I think that's going to be held very heavily against her. I mean, you got to be successful in something. At least Donald Trump can claim that he's successful in business and developing his empire. So I think you've got to remember that after these nice little events, it gets brutal. And every one of those people that was there who wants to run for president is going to be examined carefully and absolutely beaten up by the other people who want to be president. And then if they get nominated, they'll get beaten up even more by the Democrats. So you got to look into Carly Fiorina's background and see where her weaknesses are, as well as potentially her strengths.
Mm-hmm. We have a call from Jack in Cedar Rapids. Good afternoon, Jack. What's on your mind?
Good afternoon. I was just wondering if we've entered an era of perpetual campaigning and we're not really getting anything done in our legislative hubs anymore. How many world issues can be solved with $1 billion that's being poured into different campaigns, and how many people were not where they should have been, you know, a mere 2 weeks after the inauguration?
Interesting question, Jack. Thanks for your call. I mean, this is very early, talking about 2016. What do you both think of Jack's call? Tim, first?
He's right to the extent, especially if you have some of the senators like Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio or Rand Paul, who may be thinking very seriously about entering it, that they have another job, supposedly, that they're part of. The campaign season seems to, especially for those of us here in Iowa, it seems to never end. And people talk about how the ability to get anything done has narrowed, not entirely because of perpetual campaign, but because of time off and things of that nature. But of course, members of Congress do need to come back to their districts and states and do the work that they need to do there as well. So they can't always be in D.C. doing necessarily legislation. But it does become more of a problem to the extent that you do have people that are running for higher office, and it may be a distraction to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, we have about a minute left. Yeah. I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
A lot of people think that it's a really good thing to get these people out of Washington, D.C. so they can do less damage. And so, you know, some people don't object to it. And some of these potential candidates are going to become non-viable pretty quickly, and then they'll have to go back to their day job.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tim Hagel at the University of Iowa and Stephen Schmidt at Iowa State University, thank you both so much for your analysis this hour.
Welcome.
Thanks. Bye, Tim.
Thanks. Well, thank you so much for joining us this hour. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon and Claire Roth. We had help today in Ames from Jason Burns and from Dennis Reese in Iowa City. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. Coming up tomorrow on the show on River to River, talking about the Battle of the Bulge, Iowan George Dane joins us. He was caught in the middle of it. He'll recall his memories from the Battle of the Bulge and the Allied victory in Europe. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. Thanks for joining us.